Thanks very much, Joe. You've had very eloquently put the general background as far as the United Nations as a whole is concerned. And as the chairman said, I'm going to be looking at one particular aspect of it, that is the United Nations Education, Science and Cultural Organization. The United States withdrew from UNESCO nearly 2 years ago. Britain followed it last December. Joe was not quite accurate. They're not on notice of withdrawal. They went out last December. The notice was the year before. Canada and all other Western countries, including my own, Australia, are still in and give no sign at all of intending to pull out.
I can't see her. Maybe call on.
Indeed, at the symposium on UNESCO organized in this city back in the spring of this year, a representative of the Canadian Department of External Affairs was bitterly critical of the American decision to withdraw. And on that occasion, he also claimed that by staying in, Canada had acquired great influence in the organization and had been able to initiate reform and to circumscribe the power of the Director General, the by now famous Mr. Embaugh.
You'd have to ask about that.
This, as far as I can discover, is not a view widely shared of Canada's role and influence outside Canada. In fact, I haven't found anyone else who shares it. Be that as it may, I think the events of the last couple of years, as they relate to UNESCO, are worth pondering, and that they do raise some very interesting questions. How bad are things really in UNESCO? Were the United States and Britain right to pull out, or was Canada and the other countries of the West, were they right not to do so? What has happened since the United States withdrew, and why? And what are the prospects for the future? Well, those are the questions that I'll try to address briefly in talking to you now. As we're meeting in Toronto, let me begin with an anecdote, or an epiphany really, that has a Canadian flavor. About a month after I took up duty as Australian ambassador in UNESCO at the beginning of 1982, I attended what was really the first big meeting that I had been to. One attended by, I suppose, about 100 ambassadors and senior members of UNESCO Secretariat, including the great man himself, Director General Embaugh. At that meeting, Embaugh launched a violent personal attack on Pierre Trottier, then the Canadian ambassador, accusing him, among other things, of being a troublemaker and a gossip monger. As what educationists like to call a learning experience, this episode was invaluable to a new ambassador. Together with what led up to it and what followed, it exposed immediately several important truths about UNESCO in a very stark fashion. First, it showed that Embaugh, supposedly the servant of member states, felt confident enough of his power, confident enough that he was the boss in the situation, to insult publicly the representative of an important member state, one of the founding states of UNESCO, in fact. And recall that an insult to an ambassador, a public insult to an ambassador, is an insult to his country, and therefore usually regarded as a serious thing, particularly coming from an international civil servant. Second, I was amazed to find that there was absolutely no protest and not much surprise from other diplomats at this attack, none in particular from the Western ambassadors present. No defense of Trottier, though he was well regarded and was in fact the chairman of the Western group in UNESCO at that time. No complaint about the impropriety of the attack, no walkout, nothing. It was a salutary lesson learnt very early in the supine behavior of the Western states generally, what they were prepared to tolerate, how lacking they were in the instinct to protect their own interests. I can only say in defense of myself, and incidentally in defense of Ambassador Jean Girard, the American ambassador, that we both were very new, utterly finding our feet, and were taken completely by surprise by this episode. But I might say that from then on, I always had a brief, indignant speech ready in my breast pocket, which would precede a walkout if anything like what had happened to Procter were to happen to me. Third, the cause of Mbao's attack was interesting. It was Trottier's expression of concern at the late appearance of a key document, nothing less than the draft program plan for the next 6 years of UNESCO's activities. This was the first example I encountered of gross inefficiency on the part of UNESCO Secretariat under Mbao. The document failed to appear that spring in time for the executive board meeting in May, and finally came out in dribs and drabs during the summer. Having been produced, we subsequently heard from a senior member of the Secretariat in a spirit of cynical hilarity in the Secretariat during that period. This delay required an extra and very expensive meeting of the board, of the executive board, with members being brought first class, of course, from all over the world, for a special meeting in August. There were to be many such examples. And lastly, Mbao's attack on Trottier indicated that reasoned argument and debate focused on the issue were not the accepted mode of discourse in UNESCO. You played the man, not the ball. You addressed the messenger, not the message. I'd gone to UNESCO, not particularly starry-eyed. I didn't expect all that much, but not particularly cynical either. Yet during the year and a half of exposure to the organization, I reached the conclusion very quickly that it was not simply imperfect, or rather bad, or worrying. These are the usual euphemisms, but simply atrocious. Now, I wasn't alone in reaching this conclusion. It was, in fact, shared by most Westerners and quite a few third world diplomats in private. It was also shared by many of the Secretariat, some of whose senior long-serving members felt strongly enough to give up extremely well-paying jobs with very attractive perks. For example, in the brief period, the three years at the beginning of the 1980s, one Assistant Director General, Steven Hagen of Mexico, resigned, complaining of bureaucratic terrorism. The Director of the Division of Human Rights and Peace, a distinguished Swiss academic, Pierre de Senaclon, handpicked by Mbao, as it happened, wrote bitterly in a letter of resignation of a climate of distrust, prejudice, intolerance, arbitrariness, fear and civility, where no form whatever of intellectual discussion and debate is possible. And Peter Laniel, an Australian, for over 20 years the editor of UNESCO's Journal of Social Science, went complaining of the willful destruction of professionalism, of a staff atomized by suspicion and fear. Despite this sort of testimony, incidentally, there have been plenty of American academics prepared to go into bat for UNESCO and defend its record and deny all the charges against it. These men that I've just quoted were not oddballs or troublemakers. They were men who, rightly or wrongly, believed in UNESCO's ideals and in international organization to promote cooperation. And for every one of them, there were dozens of others who shared their views, but who couldn't afford to or lack the courage to make the break. In 1982, the Staff Association of UNESCO held a poll of its members. Fewer than 4% considered that UNESCO was recruiting people of high quality or promoting people on the basis of professional efficiency. In my experience, the two basic charges against UNESCO, one that it was grossly mismanaged and two that it was outrageously politicized, were both fully justified. As far as the mismanagement business is concerned, the definitive account is contained in a very sober document prepared by the General Accounting Office of Congress in a report undertaken on behalf of Congress in 1984. And the picture it gives is really a shocking one, even though it is very deadpan, objective, count with hardly a colorful adjective in the whole thing. It points to, among other things, the extraordinary centralization of the work of UNESCO. 10 years previously, the staff had been divided evenly between headquarters in Paris and workers in the field. By 1984, 70% of the total staff was concentrated in Paris. Only 30% were out there in the arid areas and the paddy fields and where the real work was supposed to be going on. And the same was true of the budget. 80% of the budget was spent in Paris. Only 20% out there. What the report had to say on the question of staffing and recruiting in the organization pointed to a great deal of the problems in UNESCO. For example, 90% of the professional staff there were kept on short 2 or 3 year contracts, given no security and left heavily dependent on the goodwill of the Director General for the extension of their employment. One can hardly think of a more effective way to make a staff compliant and docile in the hands of a Director General who knew what he wanted. And one of the most serious findings concerning staff was that the laid down methods of recruiting were substantially and routinely circumvented by a second informal system involving the large-scale hiring and rehiring of temporary or casual employees on very short-term contracts. And thus, normal criteria concerning qualifications and hiring procedures could simply be ignored. This happened on a massive scale. For example, in 1983, UNESCO hired over 2,500 people on that basis. Now, the scope for patronage, for replacing professional standards by political ones in such a system, is huge. The GAO found that there was, in UNESCO, no systematic control over the implementation of programs, no effective system for evaluating programs, no means of coordinating programs efficiently. In the handling of money, the report found that millions were spent with, quote, little accountability and only minimal assurance that the funds were used for the intended purpose. Payments were made by the Director General that were, quote, inconsistent with executive board rules, and money budgeted for one purpose was used quite freely for other purposes. Now, I can't go on and elaborate further on this, but let me point out that the GAO report was by no means representative of the whole story, because at the outset, it announced that it would not examine matters pertaining specifically to the propriety of the Director General's own conduct. And considering the charges brought against him by responsible people of systematic misuse of funds, the extensive use of patronage, the non-payment for use of UNESCO facilities, he has a huge penthouse which he demanded in the UNESCO headquarters building. Considering these charges, this is a very important limitation. Let me give you one example. The Director General has, for his private use and with little accountability at all, a sort of special fund which is at his disposal and from which he is allowed to give fellowships to individuals of his choice. When the records became available on that, it was discovered that nearly half of all the fellowships that he had given to fellow Senegalese from his own country. Now, as for the second charge of politicization, it's essential to understand the full force of this because there have been attempts to belittle it. It's not simply that UNESCO debates or would pass for such, for there are no genuine debates there. It's not that in these there is a bit of ideological bias. What has happened is that the organization has been thoroughly politicized structurally.
Anyway,
political criteria have largely replaced professional ones in appointments and promotion. The secretariat, supposedly a body of international civil servants who serve all members equally and impartially, has become debauched politically. The documents it produces, the draft programs and other policy documents which are basic to UNESCO's work, are politicized thoroughly before member states start to work on them, before they see them. The procedures and rules of the organization and its conferences are manipulated or violated to favor some groups and frustrate others. That is the most serious sense in which UNESCO is politicized. There's simply no comparison
with all this shit.
The state of affairs, say, in New York, bad as things are there. And I remember the Austrian ambassador who had served a long time in New York in a very senior position, a long time having been at the head of the organization. I remember him saying with amazement that behavior that would get people sacked instantly in New York was routine in Paris, at UNESCO. Now, the total picture that emerges from all this is of an organization in a state of absolute crisis, one that had deviated radically from its original purposes, one that wasted scarce resources freely, one that, having been created to promote cooperation, instead directed most of its energies to exacerbating conflict.
So on Monday, we can use upstairs, but on Tuesday we're...
Was the United States, was Britain right to pull out, or were Canada and the others right to stay in? Let's look at the sort of arguments that almost invariably come up that are put against pulling out. First of all, it is said, well, yes, a lot of that is true, but after all, that's only one side. UNESCO does a lot of good things too. Promotes some science cooperation.
Yeah, you can.
Combats illiteracy.
It
preserves the heritage of mankind, as it's put. This seems to me a thoroughly poor defense. First of all, because there is no system of evaluating UNESCO's work within the organization or without it, it's very difficult to know how much good work it does. Nobody knows. how the programs actually function on the ground is a matter of mystery to one and all. But let's concede that, okay, some good work is done. That is really no defense when you're talking about the use of scarce resources. One could defend virtually anything or anyone on those grounds. Even Mussolini made the trains run on time, and even Stalin increased the steel production. It's simply no defense when needs are desperate, when resources are scarce, and when the bad countervailing elements in the picture are huge. A second, and perhaps the major sort of defense for staying in, is that it is simply un-American or un-Western, undemocratic to get out because you're losing, to pick up your ball and go home, as it's sometimes put. That the democratic way is to stay in, to fight, to change things from within. After all, isn't the Western case good? Should we be afraid of open debate? Well, this line of argument simply ignores most of the realities of the state of affairs in UNESCO. First, it is simply not a debating chamber in which things are decided on their intellectual merit. It is a political forum in which things are decided in terms of political leverage.
Give me a call later on.
It's not that Embao and the Third World don't understand the Western case, and that if it were put better, they would change their mind.
It doesn't matter.
They understand it perfectly well and reject it.
Okay, give me a call later on.
And you also know.
Second, working from within and negotiating to change the UNESCO from within really amounts to negotiating with Embao. That is, negotiating with the principal architect and beneficiary of the existing rotten state of UNESCO to try to persuade him to give up his advantages. And Embao is simply no fool, and he has no intention of negotiating these things away. Third, the negotiations, in any negotiation, the deck is heavily stacked against Western countries because the whole process is controlled by him. The agendas of any meetings, the procedures of any meetings, and the implementation of any decisions arrived at. And the West simply has no leverage, either bureaucratically, in terms of control over the Secretariat, or in voting power. The only leverage the West has is the threat of withdrawal and its money power. And unless and until it is prepared to use those, very little notice will be taken of it. And one further point on this, and one that I'm inclined to make, having been involved, is what do those who argue for working from within think was attempted for years before the United States and Britain got out, along with a talented group of Western ambassadors? I worked from within for a year and a half, and we worked very hard. We were eloquent, we were sophisticated in our tactics, meticulous in our preparation, and we got absolutely nowhere, because there was no reason for us, for anybody to listen to us seriously. Another reason is that America and others would suffer from the loss of the services, particularly in the scientific field, by withdrawing from UNESCO. Well, I think that is really absolute rubbish, and gives credit to the work of UNESCO that it doesn't deserve. Dr. William Nirenberg, the chairman of the Committee on International Science for the United States, is on record as saying that there are perfectly adequate alternatives to any work going on in UNESCO, or that if there weren't, they could easily be created, and that in any case, most membership of most relevant scientific international bodies didn't depend on membership of UNESCO. And the last argument, I suppose, is that if America and Britain get out, the Soviet Union will gain influence and power. This overlooks, misunderstands the nature of the importance of UNESCO for the Soviet Union completely, both as an ideological forum and as a source of access to scientific data. The presence of the major Western countries is essential for the organization to be of any value to the Soviet Union. Without them, it is nothing. To say it was right for the United States to get out is one thing. How the United States handled its withdrawal is the fact that the British got out had nothing to do with the United States as such. It had a lot to do with the work of a few individuals who did a lot of work to publicize the question at a crucial time in London. And third, there's been absolutely no effort by the administration to explain and justify its withdrawal, an act of great symbolic significance, one would have thought. The president himself and no other has not mentioned it in any speech, has not explained to the American public why this was done, and neither has any other senior member of the administration. So the United States withdrew and took with it 25% of UNESCO's income. A year later, the British went and took another 5%. This did have some good effect, but most of the good effects were not in UNESCO, but on other organizations. And there was a marked effect on the behavior of a lot of other specialized agencies who got the message that American policy was changed and that America's willingness to finance attacks on its own basic values and interests and institutions was drawing to an end. But it did not lead to the desired reforms within UNESCO itself, partly, I think, because of these American mistakes and half-heartedness, very largely because until Mbowe himself is removed, serious reform is not possible. I'm not saying that his removal is the be-all and the end-all, but it certainly is a necessary condition for serious reform. In the year following America's withdrawal, Mbowe responded to the 25% cut in his income by employing 300 additional staff. This was a tactical move, incidentally, realizing that if people were going to be laid off later on, he wanted to be able to lay off people he did not like and have people he did like there instead. He and the Third World Bloc prevented any discussion of the GAO report by the Executive Board of UNESCO, though it's easily the most thorough study of UNESCO management that has ever been undertaken. Apart from a few cosmetic things, there were no serious efforts to reform the organization, certainly not enough to cause the British to change their mind about getting out. During this period, a general conference of UNESCO was held not in Paris, where it could have been done most effectively and economically with all the facilities in place, but significantly and symbolically in Sofia, the capital of a country which is one of the important terrorist and drug centers of the world. And the year 1985 ended with a hunger strike on the part of UNESCO staff in the foyer of the main building in Paris, which suggests that reports that staff morale is now at the point of total collapse and that work is at a virtual standstill there are true. What of the future? I think UNESCO has lost 30% of its income. It has also lost a great deal more of its reputation and status, such as it was. The concern of people in the UN now is very considerable because this organization has fouled the nest as far as they're concerned, has drawn very unwelcome attention to the organization, and in private, some of the people who are most hostile to Mbao, in private again, are UN people in New York. And their concern is very much deepened by the fact that they now know that things are going to get tougher as far as the United States is concerned. It's not a question anymore, I think, of withdrawal from this or that organization. It is, as Joe Morris said, that the whole attitude towards funding is changing with the pincer movement of Graham Rudman on one wing and the Kazabaum Amendment on the other, which is going to make things very tough. Some of you may have seen the New York Times last Sunday. There was a report on page one that the administration's policy towards the UN was being changed radically. I'm assured by people who are in a position to know that that is not true, that the position of toughening up on budgets remains. And the only problem is whether to accept the budget set by the administration, which is already much lower than last year, or to accept the level approved by the House of Representatives, which is much lower than that, or whether in the end they will have to approve the Senate figure, which is even much lower than that, and which, if accepted, would mean that there was nothing at all once NATO and other international organizations had been funded, to virtually nothing at all to give to the UN system at all. As far as UNESCO is concerned, the key certainly is in the hands of other Western states, including Canada, which is bad news because up to now they have been incredibly feeble in their approach. If even two or three of the more important of them, probably if even one of the sizable ones among them indicated that they would now follow the United States and British in getting out, unless there was root and branch reform, that would settle the matter. The whole thing has reached the point where one more straw would break things. Will they do it? Will Canada do it? I very much doubt it. These countries cling to the arguments I've already outlined and criticized. Why do they do so? I think different explanations apply to different countries, but among the reasons are these. First of all, profound cynicism, which I think is true of most of the Europeans, a lack of belief in their own cause, a relativism about values, summed up this whole cynicism. I can remember one European ambassador, when the state of UNESCO was being discussed, shrugging and paraphrasing Henry IV and saying, well, Paris is worth the mess. Second, cowardice. And I think that is the right word for it, that now so many of these countries have no greater ambition than damage limitation, which quickly degenerates into what Jean Kirkpatrick called preemptive capitulation. As Tom Pangle said last night of Canada, but I think it applies to many more, the instinct now is not to prevail or conquer, but simply to cope. And coping means staying in and muddling through if you can. A third motive, I think, is independence, a concern to be independent, fed by nationalism. And here it's crucial that you don't do it because the United States did it. And you don't want to be seen as simply following in the United States' footsteps, not saying ditto to Washington has now become a major motivation for Western states. And I think, lastly, for countries like Canada and for Australia, the search for a role is important, a distinctive identity. And the UN offers, or seems to offer, some sort of role for them as middle powers. They tend to see themselves as bridge builders between the West and the Third World, overlooking the profound truth that it is the fate of bridges to be walked over. So far, Western countries have not been able even to agree on a candidate to put up against Mbowe, who is now getting ready to stand for an unprecedented third term in office. And it looks as if he's going to walk in, as things are at present. They are in a complete state of disarray and ineffectuality. I would suggest that if it really desired a distinctive and decisive role in relation to UNESCO, Canada could find one by giving in December the required 12 months notice to withdraw from UNESCO, making the implementation of that notice conditional on whether or not Mbowe was elected for a third term in the fall of 87 or not. Doing so would not be following the US lead. On the contrary, Canada could claim that it had tried the course of working for change from within for 2 years after the US left, and that its decision was now taken only because there had been no serious reform in that period, and that the prospect of the re-election of Mbowe ruled out the likelihood of any such reform occurring. But as taking such a course would go beyond mere coping, I guess that it's unlikely to happen. Thank you.